Les colloques du Collège de France.
It is an honor to be here. I am very happy to be here with you today. Is the mic okay? Everyone can hear me? I'm very happy to be here with you today. Of course, I want to thank Natalie, Muriel, Pierre-Yves, and Michelle for the invitation to participate in this colloquium. My thanks also to Anne-Sophie and Marina and the other staff for their superb organization. And I'm looking forward to sharing thoughts about contributions that sociology can make to thinking about and understanding the social production of health inequalities. And this is, of course, a very fraught time to be talking about this topic or about many other topics. And I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the very difficult, very challenging environment which we are in now. And so I'm even more grateful to the colloquium organizers for this opportunity, which is needed now more than ever. So I would like to use my time to share three sociological concepts or tools that those in my discipline in the US often use to point to and to analyze the impacts of macro, meso, and micro-level social processes on the health of bodies, communities, and populations. Obviously, there are many more than three concepts that sociology has produced to help us think about health inequalities. The three that I will be speaking about are simply my own personal list. It's a partial selection, but they are ones that I've found to be very generative in my own work, and in one case, emerge from my own research. And they are also tools that I believe have real interdisciplinary possibilities, which is why I chose to offer them here. More generally, I'm hoping that my remarks will spark some conversation about the synergies between theoretical and empirical work, and also the gaps where we have one but not the other, and the tools we will need to move our understandings of health inequities forward. So, as I begin, a unifying claim across all three of the tools that I'll be presenting about today is that they all theorize about social exposure and seeks to analyze how suffering is socially produced. They argue that inequality is not a bug or an error in our health and social systems. Rather, it is a feature of those systems. Those systems are actually functioning as they should be. They produce inequality by design. These systems commit what Rob Nixon, in speaking about environmental injustice, has called slow violence, a violence that occurs gradually and out of sight, a violence of delayed destruction that is dispersed across time and space, an attritional violence that is typically not viewed as violence at all, a violence that is neither spectacular nor instantaneous, but rather incremental and accretive. One that leads to long dyings. So, to begin. So the first tool that I'd like to present on is fundamental cause theory. This, I believe, is a deeply sociologically informed and theoretically powerful explanation of health disparities and their multi-causal and durable nature. It takes up long-standing traditions in the study of health and disease that Natalie has already referred to that integrate sociological concerns with epidemiological approaches. The core proposition of this theory, according to sociologists Bruce Link, Joe Phelan, and their colleagues, is that certain social conditions constitute fundamental causes of disease. And I'd like to just pause to emphasize that they are talking about social conditions, not social identities, not individual characteristics, but the condition of being, of having a social exposure. And these social conditions, they refer to as, quote, factors that involve a person's relationships to other people. These include everything from relationships with intimates to positions occupied within the socioeconomic structures of society, factors like race, socioeconomic status, and gender. And they also include stressful life events of a social nature. So these social conditions have a fundamental relationship to health because they involve access to resources that help us avoid risks for disease and to ameliorate the consequences of disease when it occurs. These resources include things like knowledge, money, power, social status, prestige, social connections, and freedom. all of which profoundly shape people's ability to avoid risks and minimize the consequences of risk exposure and disease. These resources are broadly serviceable, flexible, they are multi-purpose, they are transportable from one situation to another, and therefore they have wide-ranging utility. These socially distributed resources accrue disproportionately to the socially and economically privileged and act at both the individual and the contextual levels. As Phelan and colleagues write, at the individual level, flexible resources can be conceptualized as the cause of causes or risk of risks that shape individual health behaviors by influencing whether people know about, have access to, can afford, and receive social support for their efforts to engage in health-enhancing or health-protective behaviors. In addition, resources shape access to broad contexts that vary dramatically in associated risk profiles and protective factors. For example, a person with many resources can afford to live in a high SES neighborhood where neighbors are also of high status and where collectively enormous clout is exerted to ensure that crime, noise, pollution, violence, traffic, and vermin are minimized, and that the best healthcare facilities, parks, playgrounds, and food stores are located nearby. Once a person has used SES-related resources to locate in an advantaged neighborhood, a host of health-enhancing circumstances comes along as a package deal. Similarly, a person who uses educational credentials to procure a high-status occupation inherits a package deal that is more likely to include excellent health benefits and less likely to involve dangerous conditions and toxic exposures. In these circumstances, the person benefits in numerous ways that do not depend on his or her own initiative or ability to personally construct a healthy situation. It is an add-on benefit operative at the contextual level. More formally, we can think of fundamental causes of disease as having four criteria. First, it involves multiple disease outcomes. A fundamental cause is associated not just with one or a few limited number of health conditions, but is linked to a multiplicity of them. Second, it involves multiple risk factors for health, what Jeremy Friese and Karen Lutfi-Spencer have called, quote, massively multiple mechanisms. Put together, the first and the second criteria mean that fundamental causes are mechanisms that link multiple risk factors to multiple diseases, that create multiple pathways to multiple health outcomes. Third, fundamental causes invoke flexible resources that people can use to avoid disease risks or minimize the consequences of disease. This is why the sociology of stratification, how we sort and stratify, is intimately tied to fundamental cause theory, because we are not in an even playing field. Rather, the initial unequal distribution of resources comes from somewhere and is maintained over time. Finally, the relationship of fundamental causes to health is reproduced via the replacement of intervening mechanisms and the ways that retain the, quote, systemic asymmetry where fundamental causes affect health mostly in one direction rather than the reverse. In this way, the causal linkages and pathways between specific social conditions, specific social exposures, and their disease outcomes may change or shift in salience without altering the underlying fundamental relationship between those social conditions and health. As Link and colleagues note, when innovations beneficial to health are developed in our society, their implementation necessarily occurs within the context of inequalities in knowledge, money, power, prestige, and social connections. As knowledge is produced about the health effects of a risk factor, or as new risks or new treatments arise, those able to command more resources are in a better position to take advantage of this new knowledge, to avoid new risks, and to access new treatments. That is, the already advantaged benefit disproportionately from improved capabilities to prevent and control disease. This perspective argues that at the end of the day, biomedical or even public health interventions at the individual risk factor level are inefficient and will only have limited success as the roots of disease and its stratified distribution lie further upstream. Indeed, our ever-growing capacity to reduce risks and to ameliorate illness in combination with existing social inequalities only serve to reproduce existing health inequities and to even exacerbate them during times of biomedical and technoscientific advancement. In contrast, attempts to alleviate the social inequities themselves would likely yield downstream benefits in reducing health inequalities and preventing morbidity and mortality for everyone. So multiple studies have confirmed this fundamental cause claim that new health-related knowledge and innovations disproportionately accrue to those who are better off. Specific examples include cancer screening and surveillance, including mammography and pap tests for gynecological screening, the growing ability to manage some diseases and prevent serious outcomes, such as pharmacological treatment for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and depression, and shifts in risk after research that shows the harmful effects of, for example, smoking or hormone replacement therapy. Through the stratification of the uptake and subsequent benefits of newfound abilities to control disease and enhance health, existing social and economic inequalities are repeatedly reproduced to cumulatively build deepening patterns of morbidity and mortality. The second theoretical tool that I'd like to offer is more of a heuristic rather than a standalone framework or concept. The notion that social structures are durable and tend to reproduce the existing order because they are composed of institutions that interlock with one another and are mutually reinforcing. While this general understanding of social systems is widely shared in sociological and other disciplinary conceptions of social and health inequality, Gil G. and Margaret Hicken have helpfully captured this perspective through the metaphor of a chemical molecule called Buckminster fullerene, or more colloquially, the buckyball. They use the buckyball as a way to distinguish between structural racism on the one hand and the social institutions that perpetuate it on the other. So, as you can see, this molecule has a spherical cage-like structure. On the left is a stylized version of the buckyball molecule that appears in the G. and Hicken article. And on the right is a photo I took in San Francisco outside of our local science museum that shows nested buckyballs, one that's inside the other. So each node is interconnected to other nodes, forming webs that together construct a structure that is extremely stable because of this interlocking nature. G. and Hicken argue that we can think of social institutions that perpetuate institutional racism as constituting the individual atoms or nodes of the buckyball, and the entire molecule can represent structural racism. The buckyball structure is extremely strong and stable because forces exerted on a single atom or node are distributed throughout the entire molecule. And in the same way, structural racism derives its strength and resilience from the interconnections among racializing social institutions. A few other notes about the buckyball metaphor or heuristic. First, even a single social institution is not any one thing. It is not a single node or a single atom, but is itself composed of subsystems that are interdependent and mutually reinforce each other. This is why institutions tend towards stability. So think about the last time you experienced the feeling of bureaucracy, where you're told this is the way that it is because that is the way that it has always been, this is the way that we do things. We often experience this as institutional or organizational inertia. This experience emerges in large part because institutional subsystems are like buckyballs. They're interconnected to each other and to other organizations in the field. And this interdependence is what resists change and reinforces the status quo. A second observation is that the atoms that make up the buckyball do not operate in isolation, Rather, through the bonds that connect them, they operate under shared chemical rules and principles. So analogously, Gee and Hicken argue that the social institutions that make up structural racism also follow similar norms and practices that are racialized and reinforce and reinstantiate racial hierarchies. Individual social institutions, for example, labor markets, housing, environmental protection, the criminal legal system, and healthcare, work to reproduce the prevailing order and to replicate inequities within their specific domains. They do not each go about making up their own rules and their own practices and their routines. Rather, they are borrowing and mimicking and mirroring those of social institutions that exist in the field. So these practices order our lives in these very patterned ways. They contain some common default assumptions about how to organize social action. These assumptions are expressed in institutionalized norms and routines that then have consequences for distributing resources. Institutional practices diffuse throughout fields and subsystems. They travel throughout the buckyball, mutually reinforcing each other. These inter-institutional connections create and maintain cascades where social inequalities in one institutional domain interact with, are contingent on, and actually amplify inequities in other institutional domains. For example, Gee and Hicken cite the co-maintenance of racial residential segregation along with the racially unequal exposures to environmental hazards. Housing markets and the ways that real estate is valued, race-based segregation, land use zoning laws, banking and real estate industry practices, they work hand in hand to facilitate the compounding of housing, economic, and environmental inequities. The COVID-19 pandemic also demonstrated the inter-institutional connections between residential, educational, and occupational segregation, and public health and healthcare underinvestment that intertwine to concentrate exposures, resources, and mortality by race and gender and class. Together, these heterogeneous institutions and the common practices and interactions that bind them to each other operate to maintain structural inequity as a whole. The American sociologist Victor Ray offers an allied concept of what he calls racialized organizations that provides an important theoretical and empirical complement. Ray conceives of as organizations Ray conceives of organizations as mechanisms that connect a racialized schemas to resources, and thus is a way to understand the resilience of the racial order. Racism is not ahistorical or only in individuals' minds, but rather it is specific, it is variable, and adapted to particular niches of institutional activity. Some theoretical details that Ray notes that I think are especially relevant for our context in thinking about health inequalities is how racialized organizations legitimate the unequal distribution of resources and enhance or diminish the agency of racial groups. And one key way they do this is by controlling time. Who waits for whom? How much time and energy it takes for different people to do things, as Owen has already mentioned, such as getting medical care, and even controlling time in the sense of stratifying life expectancy. Thus, the notion of structural racism as a buckyball and the complementary concept of racialized organizations together argue that we must analyze institutions and their norms and practices, how they interconnect and often reproduce one another, in order to fully identify and intervene in the social relationships that constitute the status quo. This demands a tripartite attention to individual social institutions or nodes, to the institutional practices or bonds that serve as connective tissue among them, to the entire structure, the entire system of structural inequality as a whole. No matter what the intentions of individuals are, power-laden institutional contexts and dynamics can produce inequitable outcomes because of the buckyball nature of institutional rules, procedures, and practices. In this way, inequity is often baked in. It is a feature, not a bug or a flaw in our social systems. Conversely, these tools can also show where meso-level changes in rules and practices are needed that can transform social institutions, how they interact with marginalized communities, and the effects that they have on the stratification of life chances. Reliance on the virtue of individual institutional actors or even single organizations is not tenable. Rather, recognition of and intervention on the institutions, their interconnections, and the entire buckyball as a whole are critical to achieve equity more broadly. Okay, complementing these more upstream macro-level frameworks and meso-level processes, I now want to move to offering the concept of cultural health capital that seeks to address two key questions. How, in the context of healthcare, do broad social structural inequalities manifest in clinical encounters? And two, how interactional phenomena accumulate to produce systemic inequalities in healthcare? So here I am sort of moving from the first and the second frameworks that I presented to this one up the spiral of the Gendy model that Natalie presented. So the concept of cultural health capital traces its intellectual roots, of course, to Pierre Bourdieu's notion of cultural capital. And might I say it is very surreal for me to be discussing Bourdieu here at the Collège de France. And so thank you again for this honor and opportunity, special opportunity. So Bourdieu argued, of course, that cultural products and practices of all kinds, styles of dress, eating habits, verbal skills, scientific knowledge, educational credentials, and so on, these all function as forms of capital. Bourdieu explicitly linked cultural products and practices and their unequal transmission, deployment, and systems of rewards to the struggle for social distinction, practices of social domination, and the maintenance of class-based hierarchies. However, capital is not simply a passive resource that one has, but rather, as Bourdieu wrote, is a structured set of social relations. It is less a thing and more of a form of power, a capacity to act. It has a kind of energy and is a mode of being and acting, as the Australian sociologist Fran Collier has put it. Analogous to Bourdieu's notion of cultural capital, cultural health capital is defined as the capacity, hold on a second, here we go, okay. Analogous to Bourdieu's notion of cultural health capital is defined as the capacity to display and leverage a specialized set of cultural skills, behaviors, and interactional styles that are valued and leveraged as assets by both patients and healthcare providers in clinical encounters. So crucially, cultural health capital is in the eye of the beholder. Whether someone can successfully mobilize it for more clinical attention, less gatekeeping to medical resources, and favorable relationships to providers is determined by institutions and institutional actors who have the power to set the rules of engagement. In many contemporary healthcare systems, cultural health capital may include things like knowledge of biomedical information, the ability to communicate that knowledge efficiently, the capacity to adjust one's interactional style, organizational savvy, and cues of favorable social and economic status, such as verbal skills, ways of dress, styles of self-presentation. And because our healthcare systems and providers, at least in the Western world, reward patient initiative, self-knowledge, and self-management, cultural health capital can also include displaying an instrumental attitude towards one's own body, a proactive stance towards managing one's health, belief in the value of, and the ability to practice self-discipline, and an orientation towards the future and its control through calculation and action. So these cultural capacities and modes of being and acting are critical to the ability of patients and healthcare professionals to effectively engage and communicate with one another. Because these resources, as forms of capital, have exchange value in healthcare interactions, the stratified distribution of cultural health capital shapes the relationships particular patients have with particular providers, as well as the care offered and received. Its interactional and transactional give and take nature adds to our understanding of how these resources impact clinical encounters by underscoring the instrumental as well as the symbolic ways in which cultural health capital operates as a means of exchange. So while some patients may be strategic and deliberate in their acquisition and mobilization of cultural health capital, as with Bourdieu's cultural capital, a lot of the time we are not calculatingly deploying cultural assets to achieve planned goals. Instead, cultural health capital is developed over time through a process of embodiment, rooted in our past experiences, our socialization as children and as adults, the kinds of worlds in which we have traveled in throughout our lives. Much as Luc Boltanski observed in 1971 in his work on the social uses of the body and his concept of medical competence that Natalie has already mentioned, cultural health capital develops in and through interactions with healthcare systems and professionals, and the repeated enactment of health-related behaviors and practices, like consuming biomedical knowledge and engaging in self-surveillance and risk-reducing behaviors. As such, the ways in which patients and providers interact towards one another and the kinds of actions we can take to maintain our health are often hybrid combinations of purposeful actions and habitual ones. They are sometimes conscious, but oftentimes unconscious ways of thinking. They can be both overtly strategic and intentional, but more often they are unplanned ways of conducting our lives. So a number of papers have deployed the concept of cultural health capital in different domains of healthcare. For example, I worked with Leslie Dubin and Jamie Chang to study how the skills and attributes that comprise cultural health capital directly facilitate what we in the US have called, quote, patient-centered care. We have found that cultural health capital helped to explain the power providers have to define the kinds of resources, behaviors, and skills that they value, and that in turn generates the motivation and the ability of healthcare professionals to render their care more patient-centered. We also use cultural health capital to analyze how the stigma of substance use impacts clinical interactions. People who use illicit substances were routinely stigmatized, but some to a greater degree than others. There were times when patients actively mobilized cultural health capital to successfully mitigate some of the stigma of substance use. But for other patients, substance use stigma so overwhelmed the interaction that any cultural health capital that they tried to leverage went unrecognized by their provider. In other studies, Sidi Narasat and colleagues explored the social and cultural underpinnings of the mistreatment of women during childbirth in a northern province in India. These authors point to the unequal access to opportunities to acquire cultural health capital and how this disadvantaged poor women during childbirth. Providers set the expectations and norms regarding valued behaviors at medical facilities. Patients with lower social standing did not always understand these expectations and were more likely to suffer poor outcomes as a result. Sarah Rubin laid a paper for another study of ours in which we used the framework of cultural health capital to account for disparities in pain treatment by safety net healthcare providers. Patients with serious chronic pain not only struggle with physical pain, but also frequently deal with multiple other health challenges and often experience social suffering from housing and food insecurity and poverty. And so when they sought care at the public hospitals that we were studying in the US, they found themselves having to leverage context-specific forms of cultural health capital in order to advocate effectively for pain medication. Those who were unsuccessful in doing so encountered multiple obstacles to getting their pain medically managed. They were labeled as being quote unquote high risk, a label that comes with high stakes consequences, given that physicians prescribing practices for opioids have encounter a lot of heightened scrutiny because of the opioid crisis. And because pain is a mostly embodied, an internal experience, a subjectively reported, there are no ways to measure it other than to ask patients if they are experiencing it. It provided an empirical situation in which we could see how patients sought to mobilize cultural health capital and how it served to exacerbate and only occasionally mitigate existing healthcare inequalities along racial, class, and gender lines. In the inpatient setting, Amanda Gengler found that cultural health capital can be leveraged to show how families whose children were diagnosed with life-threatening and often rare diseases accessed and negotiated medical care at a top-tier university hospital in the US. Those who mobilized cultural health capital effectively were able to secure what Gengler calls micro-advantages, reflecting how inequalities are reproduced and lead to different levels of care. And finally, Elizabeth Gage Bouchard underscores the importance of cultural knowledge, interactional styles, and self-presentation in parents' differential ability to obtain cancer treatment for their children. By identifying variable styles of vigilant, trusting, or antagonistic advocacy, and the socioeconomic patterning of which parents exhibit which styles, Gage Bouchard traced how similar levels of cultural health capital can lead to different kinds of interactions within the clinic. This differential treatment depended on the cultural dispositions and styles of parents and whether and how they matched those of the providers from whom they were seeking care. Finally, I would like to consider the stakes and the consequences of the broad social processes that I've described, and I think that we've heard about and we will continue to hear about more through the course of today. I'd like to share some very recent thinking that I've been doing about the influence of structural, institutional, and interactional systems and practices and their effects on all of us, on the ground, at an experiential and embodied level. Here, I am not just speaking about the health effects, per se, though clearly the health inequalities are critical and urgent, but rather of how they shape our relationship to each other and to the social institutions that populate our world and shape our actions. For this, I'm turning first to the sociologist Ruha Benjamin, who leverages the work of other sociologists John Johnson and Andrew Melnikoff. Benjamin conceives of trust and distrust as, quote, learned dispositions that reflect objective socioeconomic and cultural political conditions. Ruha Benjamin, Johnson, and Melnikoff, along with many other social scientists, have commented on the need to frame trust, mistrust, and distrust as structurally and institutionally produced and not solely an interpersonal dynamic. This move to focus on the structural and the institutional mirrors the core arguments of the fundamental cause, buckyball, and cultural health capital frameworks that I have described. The sociologists Monica Bell and Meredith Van Netta have taken this cue to interrogate the lack of trust in their respective works on the criminal legal system. Monica Bell has coined the term legal estrangement to refer to, quote, a marginal and ambivalent relationship with society, the law, and predominant social norms that emanates from institutional and legal failure. Working to better understand the relationships between police and the communities they purport to serve, Bell disagrees with explanations of a lack of trust that de-emphasize deeper structural, group-centered approaches to the problem of policing. Instead, she argues that legal estrangement, quote, reflects the intuition among many people in poor communities of color that the law operates to exclude them from society. The notion of legal estrangement captures this collective orientation, not an individual one, of being excluded and alienated, and points to the structural conditions that give rise to these experiences. In sociological theory, the concept of estrangement is seen as the opposite of solidarity. Social situations where norms are agreed upon and reinforced are socially cohesive, they promote social trust, and maintain social bonds. In contrast, when norms are violated, when individuals and institutions are situated in ways that act against the norms and goals of the group, social bonds are broken, resulting in alienation and enemy. Bell notes that enemy is more than distrust. Indeed, instead, it is a sense that the very fabric of the social world is in chaos, a sense of social estrangement, meaninglessness, and powerlessness, often a result of structural instability and social change. For Bell, legal estrangement arises from direct experiences of being treated unfairly by the police, but expands to what she calls the cultural level. At this level, the negative experiences of others, even those outside of one's own social network, feed into a vicarious and collective memory of police interaction, and a collectively generated understanding of how seemingly neutral laws and policies operate and are enforced in systematically discriminatory ways. Importantly, by teasing apart illegitimacy from estrangement, Bell is able to explain how those who may see the police and the law as legitimate may still feel estranged from them. Meredith Van Natta has applied the concept of legal estrangement to her empirical study of how US anti-immigrant laws have insinuated themselves into healthcare institutions. She has found that anti-immigrant rhetoric pervades clinical spaces to change healthcare institutions, healthcare practices, and reduce immigrants' life chances. Medical and social service providers are increasingly enrolled as agents and sometimes themselves are the targets of surveillance and punitive tactics that have permeated immigrant healthcare in the US. And of course, these tactics have only dramatically intensified in recent weeks and months. These moves have chilling effects on immigrants seeking healthcare, seeking access to key institutional benefits, and on the workers who provide those benefits. These intertwining dynamics that tie healthcare institutions to legal institutions effectively surveil, punish, and exclude, generating legal estrangement and enacting what Van Natta terms medical legal violence. I would like to take Bell and Van Natta's arguments even further, bringing the productive concept of estrangement fully into the clinic and the healthcare enterprise to argue that there is what we might call biomedical estrangement. We can think of biomedical estrangement as constituting an ambivalent relationship with mainstream biomedicine and healthcare, a growing collective position and experience of alienation from biomedicine's predominant social norms, emanating from institutional failure and from symbolic and structural exclusion. Even while, or regardless of whether, individuals see biomedical knowledge and care as legitimate and authoritative, some groups perceive that these institutions and the benefits and care that they offer are not for them. The stratified and systematic ways in which discrimination is inflicted on marginalized groups fuels the collective memory built upon both the direct harms that people have endured themselves, as well as the vicarious marginalization of others. Biomedical science and care are rife with ostensibly neutral rules, practices, policies, criteria, clinical guidelines, infrastructures, biotechnologies. Yet they rationalize and underpin discriminatory interactions, stratified care, and unequal outcomes. This structural exclusion accretes and compounds from the micro to the meso to the macro level and then back down again to systematically and differentially distribute health risks and benefits, harms and care. Together, these produce a growing detachment, a sense of alienation and enemy from biomedicine and from healthcare. Thus, not just health inequities, but also biomedical estrangement are the stakes of the continued operation of the fundamental social causes of disease, of not intervening on the buckyballs that reproduce health inequities, and of misrecognizing the role of cultural health capital and other forms of capital in stratifying health and healthcare. So the concepts that I've shared today are deeply helpful for me to make better sense of the myriad phenomena, statistics, and trends that demonstrate how health and illness are stratified, and to discern how to go about interrogating them. But again, these concepts are simply my own partial list, my own personal list, And I'm eager to hear from all of you, whether they speak to you, whether they resonate with the evidence and the disciplinary knowledge that you have, whether they expand and extrapolate and translate to other sorts of questions and to our interdisciplinary work. So I very much look forward to that conversation, and thank you so much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.